edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Natural Resources Subcommittee. Today we are continuing our hearing, public hearing on Senate Bill 5530. And that is the budget for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Let's begin with a distribution of supplementary materials that answer questions that were previously asked. So.
Okay. Subcommittee members, you will find underneath your agenda three handouts. They respond to different questions that you asked earlier this week. The largest packet of questions is in response to Transportation Growth Management Program and the question that was asked about the grants that were made there and how what percentage of those grants were related to transportation work. And this material attempts to respond to that. The two smaller questions sheets that you have relate to farm and forest land losses and the information on the counties that are exempt in the periodic review process. Maybe you could look through the material briefly for a minute, and the department's here to answer any questions about this material before we proceed and back through the presentations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
Almost. I didn't want to know what percentage was transportation related. I wanted to know what the transportation element is. Your definition of transportation is broader than mine, so I wanted to know in each one of the projects, actually one of the projects too, although you gave them to me in another booklet.
Excuse me.
So, I mean, where I see like 94%, 67%, I actually wanted to see what the project was so that I could... or at least what piece of it was transportation. I think we have something else that shows what the project is, but doesn't necessarily show its relationship to transportation, so that I could sort of gauge for myself.
Senator Dukes, Anna can chime in here, for each of these projects, there is an analysis that is part of becomes part of the agreement, the grant agreement between us and the recipient of the grant. So for the, I don't know how many are here, 100 and some odd, we've got that kind of agreement. Maybe the thing to do would be to, if you have a particular one in mind, we can show you that grant agreement and the analysis of the transportation element of it, or a sampling of them, or something like that.
If I understood correctly yesterday, somebody initially says, yes, this will meet the general litmus test of at least 50% transportation. And so at some point, I assume there's somebody that says, I mean, I understand what an Oregon a transportation system plan is, and you're right, it's 100%, but... you know, a downtown plan. I'm curious about finding out, like, are we talking about people drive on the streets in downtown and so therefore there's a transportation piece, but we're really looking at how downtown is laid out? Or were we really doing, there's too many cars downtown, and so we have to take a look at how we manage those. I mean, you can move transportation into anything you want to, as long as it's close to a street or a bus line or an airport. But that doesn't mean that you're actually doing transportation work as part of the project. And I was trying to get a feel myself for what is it we're doing on the... Yesterday, when I was looking through the book, some of them looked pretty... iffy to me, and I'm just trying to get a sense as to where the money's going and what kind of transportation things it's being spent on. So, and you can not worry about the transportation plans. I know what those are, and I understand the need for them, and that's all they are, is transportation related. There isn't anything else.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dukes, if on page, in the written portion of the memo, starting on page 3, there is an explanation of the transportation relationships and benefits kind of generically by type of grant. And so, like you said, Category 1, transportation system planning, that's a very small explanation. Category 2 describes generally the kinds of transportation relationships and benefits for integrated transportation and land use plans, and then the same for, on the following page, the remainder of the types of work that is done. So there is in this memo at least some explanation of the direction and thinking that went into determining the transportation relationships.
And I appreciate that, and maybe I'm just not communicating well, or maybe I just can't get there from here. I would actually like for each of the projects some line that says what the transportation piece was, so that I can take a look at that and try to understand that. I trust you guys on a whole lot of things. I have to say this isn't one of them, so no offense. It's just where I am.
Just to clarify, you would like that for grants and projects other than the TSP type?
And again, the the form in which we have that is the grant agreement, right, between us and the local government, which would one thing I want to make sure you understand, we get the applications from a local government for a grant, and there is often negotiation back and forth between the department and the local government about the final form of the project. So it's only at the end, and that's why it's in the grant document, that the final analysis of the transportation element of it is agreed upon and written down. At the beginning, you might not see it. So that's what we could give to you. We could give you the either extract that portion of the grant agreement, or if you'd like, the whole grant agreement.
I don't necessarily need the whole grant agreement. I just somehow or other want to know for each of the projects what was the transportation piece, and I don't need it before you negotiated it all out, just sort of when you do the project what was or will be the transportation piece. I mean, there's $137,000, well, $274,000, I guess $137,000 must be the transportation piece for a concept plan. I don't know what that is, so it's hard to gauge that, and even some of the others, a Main Street plan really should have transportation in it, but what I'm looking is to sort of try to gauge for myself, again, is that we were trying to spiff up the downtown and fill all of the empty storefronts, oh, and by the way, you get to downtown by driving, or was it there's a lot of congestion in that downtown, and that's impacting all of those businesses, and we need to try to do some better planning so we can accommodate the businesses and the communities.
Okay.
Not even close.
Better luck tomorrow.
Senator, are you satisfied with this report? Is this what you had in mind?
No, but we'll get there.
And Mr. Benner, I have your commitment that you'll get there with the senator answering your questions.
Yes, we will.
Thank you. The other documents that are contained are in the distribution have to do with the conversion of farm and forest land to other uses and the information on exempt counties and the periodic review process. And the chair has a question about the conversion issue. It mentions in the memo that this details the conversion of farm land and forest land to rural, residential, commercial, industrial, and other uses. And I just wondered, farmland can be converted by planting trees into forest lands, afforestation. And that is actually a feature of some of the conversions, although this just details, I believe, the conversion to a residential, commercial, or industrial category. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Because it's my impression that afforestation over the last decade has meant that we actually have more land in forest today than we did 10 years ago. So I was curious if the department does any afforestation comparisons to look at land uses that may be increasing in the forestry category. Similarly, we've got some ag land that was brought under irrigation that had previously been native pasture or not improved. And that would add to the store of ag land that's cultivable. And I just wondered if the department looks at, I guess you'd call it farm conversion or improvement to farming lands as sort of a countervailing issue to the conversion of ag and forest land to urban and industrial uses. Do you also track the conversion of underutilized lands through reforestation or afforestation and underutilized lands that are improved and converted to ag uses? Do you track that stuff?
Senator, we do not track that.
Before he answers, well, yes. may I?
Sure.
And I interject. The same question was on my mind because it comes to my mind, Mr. Chairman, that across the span of centuries, particularly in Europe and so on, that most residential areas were converted to farmland and back and forth across the centuries. So there seems to be some sort of flux that not only the type of material that the chairman is describing, but even residential areas or industrial areas may in fact cease to be those categories and grow up into brush and forest land because nature does that,
sure.
You know, willy-nilly, whether we like it or not. So my question would have been, and he already asked it, there must be an ebb and flow going both ways.
Senator, a little more detail. What we derive this from are the reports that come to us for counties on an annual basis. You enacted a statute about 15 years ago requiring counties to tell us, report to us annually, any shift in zoning categories. They also tell us about all dwellings, all land divisions, all conditional use permits and farmers forest zones. So that's where we get this information. Among the things that they tell us are shifts of land from a farm zone to a forest zone, or vice versa. So we do have that data. We don't consider that to be a conversion, at least not as we thought you were thinking of it. We thought what you were after was a loss. And since the commission has never particularly cared about land moving from farm into forest or forest into farm, we didn't think you thought of that as a loss. We do not track the shift of actual land use, say, from agriculture to forestry or the reverse. Others do. The NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, when it does its, I forget how often it does, maybe every 5 years, maybe every 10, it will record shifts of land from crops to range, from range to forest, or any combination thereof. But we don't track that.
Similarly, the question occurred to me, do you track the conversion of private land to public ownership?
No, we don't. We get notification when land is proposed for shifting from fee to trust by one of the federally recognized tribes in the state. And that's relatively recent. We do keep track of that. But a shift of ownership from private to public, we don't get that information.
Okay, and then I would guess similarly there's no tracking of conversion from public ownership to private ownership.
We do not track that either, Senator.
Well, I guess the point, colleagues, was just to suggest that conversions don't always mean loss. Because the land underlies all, and that there is a very real trackable afforestation in Oregon. That's the planting of trees in areas where perhaps they were not growing before. We heard a lot about the use of poplar and other deciduous hardwood trees in riparian areas and also in remediation of industrial sites. and that's making new forests, but it's converting wetlands. We also, for instance, the R.D. Offutt property and the leases and the sale there may convert tens of thousands of acres from public ownership into private ownership. And that'll be, some of it will be, by agreement, habitat for listed species, and others will be irrigated acreage. But that'll be a conversion of desert land to farm uses. So it's an increase in the stock of arable farmlands, and it's a significant number of acres. And that ought to be balanced, I think, against the idea that every conversion from a farm or a forestry use is a net loss to Oregonians. It may not be. It's a conversion for sure, but conversions necessarily are not always bad. More troublesome, I think, is the conversion of private land to public ownership, because it reduces the stock of usable lands that are in the inventory for some kind of beneficial use in development, either as a farm or as a productive tax-paying unit. It doesn't mean a loss necessarily, because there are productive beneficial uses that the public makes of that land as well. And there are conversions from public to private, although they are rare. It's just one of those things where we're going to look at a box score. I'd love to see more categories. I don't want to make more work for the department, but I think Oregonians don't get a clear picture of anything but the loss column when we talk about conversion of farm and forest land to industrial and residential uses. More is going on.
It's possible, there. Senator, that the Division of State Lands keeps track of that. I mean, they would at least keep track of it for their own lands, and I would imagine they also keep track of it for the lands with federal agencies with whom they do trades, such as the Bureau of Land Management.
I guess the interesting thing for me, I think the afforestation actually has created more acres of forest land in Oregon than we've converted for other uses. But
well, Mr. Chairman, this probably ranges into the realm of policy, but I'd be interested in hearing at least the chairman's opinion of it. We're currently hearing bills on the floor of the House that deal with the plight of the Oregon farmer, and that they cannot make a profit on their crops due to NAFTA and general trade and tariff agreement and competition from overseas. And the thought occurred to me as I listened to that yesterday, how much of our farmland is going vacant? While it may be on the roster as farmland, it's not being farmed. And how much of that will there be in the future? Will we have a large underutilized or unused acreage of farmland in the future?
It's possible. The issue is that because those private lands are on the tax rolls, usually on a deferral basis, the lands are banked for a longer period of time. There isn't a direct consequences of fallow land, so it may be a feature. I don't know. I'll have to ask some folks in the Natural Resources Substantive Committees if there's any tracking of that kind of issue. The other report, of course, was the exemption that was provided, certain counties of small relative population, exempting them from the periodic review process. And so, colleagues, if you're interested in seeing who's in and who's out of the periodic review process, I reviewed that document. Thank you, Mr. Benner, on bringing the committee up to speed on the questions and answers that the agency brought in response to those questions. We're in the process of the completion of the operations dash urban portion. Anna Rousseau was interrupted the other day by the need to move on to the coastal processes. But let's return now to the days of yesteryear when operations had the podium and ask them to resume their presentation where it was left off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Anna Rousseau, manager of the Urban Division for Department of Land Conservation and Development. I believe we had started on page 3 of the part 2 details. I think we're basically got through that page, so I will move on to the next portion, which is page 6, that talks about some of the services for that the division provides. The Urban Division has 18 FTE. Approximately about four staff provide services to periodic review and plan amendment review and technical assistance and grant management services to the metro area and outlying cities and cities within metro and to the larger cities of the Willamette Valley. the cities elsewhere are actually staffed by people in the other divisions, but that requires a great deal of communicating. One of those four FTE is the urban coordinator, and his responsibilities are making sure that there is that coordination across division lines, and also acting as kind of a technical resource for urban issues and providing assistance in, both to staff internally as well as to local governments. The remainder of the staff in the division are part of the Transportation and Growth Management Program, and they provide primarily technical assistance and expertise and grant management in the area of transportation planning. I'll get to that more in a moment. But one of the major services is providing technical assistance to in large cities in the Portland metro area. And some examples of that, we've recently, as you know, Madras has a prison that will be sited in the community. And working with that community, the Department of Corrections funded a study that identified the need for an expansion of the urban growth boundary to accommodate the housing and other things that would be coming as a result of the prison expansion. So our staff is working closely with the City of Madras and with the other agencies involved to provide them with a good guidance on how to get through the urban growth boundary amendment process and working with them on that. The other major activity is managing the grants that the department provides, both periodic review and technical assistance grants for local governments. And because those grants are often focused around an activity that is either becomes the subject of a plan amendment or is the subject of a periodic review work task, it's kind of active involvement in grant management. It's reviewing interim products. It's maybe serving on an advisory committee locally. It's actively being involved with that community as they work on their grant products. We review more than 1,000 plan amendments that are proposed by local governments each year. This often results in kind of follow-up technical assistance of many plan amendments are kind of a starting point. There's a proposal, and then the staff works with the community in addressing issues that may be out there. There are currently 59 cities that are the responsibility of our division who are in periodic review, and that includes Metro and the periodic review of the Metro Framework Plan, various elements of it. It's progressing through right now, and that's been a major work activity for the division. We participate in some of the regional planning efforts. We don't currently have direct responsibility for any of the regional problem-solving projects, but we often are involved or in some way, because like right now there's one in Lane County. Well, Eugene and Springfield are cities that we work with, so we coordinate closely with those efforts. The other thing that is part of the services is producing publications and other kind of technical assistance guides that help local governments with addressing either their statewide planning responsibilities or handling issues that come up locally that they are dealing with. The other major area of that the Urban Division provides is the Transportation Growth Management Program. We've talked around it a bit, but just so kind of bring everybody up to speed. It's a joint program of the Department of Transportation and DLCD, and its purpose is to provide technical assistance and funding for local governments to do integrated transportation and land use planning, and to primarily comply with their responsibilities for transportation system planning. The program does this primarily through providing grants to local governments and providing an array of other services. One of the services is providing technical assistance, and you know, this is just one of the publications that has come out of the Transportation Growth Management Program, the Main Street Handbook. This has been very widely used around the state, and it's to help local governments when they have a state highway running through their town center in planning in ways that both facilitate the function of the highway but also accommodate some of the interests of the local government. This biennium, we are currently providing workshops to cities focused around that handbook as a follow-up to the earlier publication. We've also provided model codes for small cities, and that was a project last biennium, and this biennium there's and a lot of it was revolved around standards for street development and access management and things like that. There's a lot of communities now who are working with this program to implement the model code and tailor it and adapt it to their community. Another note, the Federal Highway Administration provides the federal funding. The majority of the funds for this program are in ODOT's budget, and the Federal Highway Administration provides those funds. They approve the work program for the TGM program, and quarterly we meet with them and they review the projects we're working on. They review the program and can monitor progress. One other thing I wanted to mention here too is other people have mentioned it, increasingly the use of our web page as a way to communicate and provide assistance. All of the publications that are provided produced through this program are on the web and are available and accessible to anyone who is interested. We've also increasingly been using the web to through the request for proposal process, for getting consultant services, for requesting for our application process, using the web as a way to have materials available widely throughout the state. I guess flipping through the notebook, the next page is page 8 on benchmarks, and the Urban Division had one of the benchmarks. I think Mr. Benner covered that in his initial presentation, so unless there's any questions, I'll just pass by that. Okay, moving on to page 10, some of the factors affecting services. I think there are many of the same ones that have already been outlined to you in the previous presentations. The changes in Senate Bill 543 on periodic review particularly affected the Urban Division. The cities that we provide services to are those that are now required by 543 to focus their periodic review on transportation and public facilities and economic development and the other targeted priority areas that are listed in 543. That's resulted in working with those communities to either modify, tailor their current work program to make sure that they're doing those things. The other thing that I think has come from that is that the time frames, the cities that we deal with are often dealing with very, very complex issues, and in order for them to be able to complete them in a timely manner, it usually requires some level of technical assistance or grant monies or involvement by our agency to help get them through that process. Our experience in an increasing number of post-acknowledgement plan amendments. I think some of that has been growth-driven as communities are experiencing growth pressures. it just, it generates more plan amendments, and so that is a factor right now, is just the quantity of those has gone up. It also has the side effect of kind of diverting them from their long-range planning responsibilities under Senate Bill 543, because they're dealing with the day-to-day responding to permits and plan amendment proposals. The others, I think, are somewhat, you've heard before, kind of the uncertainty over endangered species issues and ballot measure 7 that has left some local governments kind of just in a wait-and-see mode and kind of wanting to see what happens with that before they move forward with too many things, and the less resources at the local government level. Okay. Page 12, the interagency agreements, there's several listed there, but I'd say the primarily we're involved in the first two, and that is the Transportation Growth Management Program with ODOT is a very much an interagency partnership, and our staff, like other DLCD field staff, is very involved with Community Solutions Team projects. Yesterday you heard about the changes in Goal 17 because of responding to changes in the economy and the need to look at waterfront development maybe more broadly. That actually came out of a Community Solutions Team effort in trying to work with Coos Bay and looking at what their range of options might be. And as the staff worked on that, one of the options became amending Goal 17. And?
Did you?
Question, yes. Senator Duke.
Yeah, the ODOT DLCD Mineral and Aggregate Agreement, that's a written agreement?
Yes.
Can I get a copy of that?
Is one more tab here, and that is on page 15, and it's the program growth and reduction. And I guess in terms of the urban division, the TGM program did, because of the OTC's action last summer, the program has been reduced, and that's reflected in the governor's recommended budget. One of the other major factors, I think, for at least for our division, is the statutory requirement that Metro update its urban growth boundary every 5 years. So this puts us in the position of working with them on that and then reviewing the proposals. And it's kind of an ongoing activity that's on a shorter time frame than most of our other periodic reviews. Now I think that's it now.
Questions from the committee? We've been worn down. We've been worn into submission.
Ready to vote, Mr. Chair.
Well, actually, we agreed to defer the work session to Monday so that the chair will be here for that.
The presentation's concluded, Mr. Chair?
Mercifully, the presentation, I believe, is concluded, except for our insightful questioning of the panel.
Then I have a question.
Ah. Right on cue.
Okay.
Representative
Crump. Dick, I was disturbed to read something in a magazine that was written by Mitch Rose. It was in Oregon Planners Journal. Familiar with this?
Yes.
He wrote an article called Top 10 Reasons Why Ballot Measure 7 is Bad for Oregon. He goes through a list of them. I guess conceptually I have a problem with a state employee being employed at the expense of the taxpayers, in essence doing an in-your-face to the voters. That causes me some distress, I must admit. Now, I heard the other day that he's no longer with the agency. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Was he with the agency when he wrote this?
I'd have to know when it was written.
You know, let's look at the date here. It says November, December 2000 is what's on the front here.
I'll check.
Okay. I just think that's wholly improper for that, you know, people can express their opinions as members of any agency because they have a First Amendment right to do so. I think that from a political perspective, it creates some liabilities in terms of the perceived objectivity of your agency when you have that type of thing being written. And that bothers me. I have to tell you, even though I have found it difficult to work with your agency in terms of the issue that we worked through last session, the youth camp bill. And I will say that I found it difficult from the respect of the starting point when it came time to where we wrote administrative rules for the bill. And I don't mean to be blindsiding you with this because I know you weren't involved in those discussions specifically. But as the language came forth, the starting point of the language from DLCD, from John Jennings, was made it impossible to implement the bill at all. And there was a poison pill in there having to do with wildlife analysis that was so broadly written, you would have never approved any camp under these conditions, ever. And it was clear. And we brought that forward in our meeting when we held it in front of our interim committee. So it bothers me that if an agency that's supposed to be working for the people, just as I am, starts from a perspective of writing administrative rules that, in essence, makes it impossible to implement the legislation. So, coupled with having read this now, it makes me wonder about the objectivity of your agency, or some of the people in it, at the very least. And if we're going to have an agency that will conduct themselves in this manner in terms of how they're doing business, then it seems to me, yes, we may be implementing the letter of the law in terms of the goals and the land use planning system, but it also seems to me we're not user-friendly. And that has to be one of the goals of any state agency, is to work for the people, because that's who we all work for in this process. So what are your feelings about that? I know you probably haven't read this, so I'm not going to ask you to comment on the specific language here, but it's pretty obvious, and Senator Farioli read it. I gave it to him yesterday. That, you know, there seems to be a certain attitude amongst some of your folks that doesn't seem to be very friendly towards a lot of folks who feel very strongly about these issues. How do you feel about that?
Representative Krupp, while you were talking, and Karen Ann Cianciabella, who knows when Mitch Rose left the employ of the agency, apparently he left September 1.
Okay.
I don't know when he wrote that piece, but I think you said the publication was November.
And yeah. So here it says he's vice president, and underneath his vice presidency it says DLCD. So the implication here, when I first read this, that he was still an employee of the agency. So if he had left the agency and he'd written it at then, that's fine. But that was a little deceiving, seeing it's DLCD here. But how do you respond to the when we started to write those administrative rules, the initial draft from your staff member made the bill impossible to implement. Why would an agency do something like that? Aren't you charged with? We pass a law, you're supposed to write the rules that make it workable. Why would we start from that kind of a baseline?
Representative Krupp, I'd have to go back and look at that. I would say probably the person who was writing those rules didn't think that his draft made it impossible to carry out the legislation. And one thing that you can be grateful for is that my agency never adopts the first draft of anything. It goes through a very lengthy, and you participate almost from start to finish, so you know how long it went on and how many iterations there were and how much public testimony there was. If there's a mindset that might have given rise to a draft that, at least in your eyes and maybe in the eyes of others, and maybe correctly so, that it would have made the legislation impossible to implement, I would say it would be this. The perspective of the department, I'm not talking about this person in particular,
right,
but the
right.
department is one of the most important things that we do is protect the farm and forest land base. And over the 20-some-odd years of the program, what seems to happen is there is a steady stream of things that detract from the protection of the land base. And consequently, I think it's built up a bit of mentality within a department that here's something else that's going to pull land out of the farmland base or the forest land base, whatever it is, and we need to be very cautious. There is undeniably, I have it myself, it pervades the department. We are very cautious about our own rules when we're asked to review legislation. We want to make sure that it doesn't unnecessarily detract from the farmland base. And I would suspect that that's probably what gives rise to what looks like maybe too cautious an effort in a first draft of a rule.
Okay. Well, Mr. Cherry, if I might, I appreciate your thoughts there. And that makes some sense to me. I had a conversation with Randy Tucker today. He was in my office. We were talking about a piece of legislation that I have that you may or may not see. And you know, he made a comment to me is that, you know, we as him saying himself as Thousand Friends, he said, you know, we feel like we're in a foxhole, and every time we stick up our head to say, yeah, we could probably do that, we get shot between the eyes. He says we're always dodging bullets. And I kind of imagine that, you know, sometimes you all feel that way too occasionally, because it doesn't seem like anything you do satisfies everyone or anyone sometimes. And I can understand that. I just I have some difficulty, though, I guess, with starting from that standpoint. And even listening to your own words right now, talking about protecting farm and forest land, what are we protecting it from? That's kind of my point. We're in a protectionist mode of thinking here. And I'm not laying that at your feet here, Dick, but I'm just saying that in terms of how we're thinking about this whole process of land use planning, we're protecting ourselves from what? And that's part of, I guess, the overall philosophical debate here. But much less, I don't want to distract from what your mission is. You have a mission. You're being charged with that mission. And I know that you're working at it diligently. I know that every time we pass a law, we make your job a little harder to deal with. It would be nice if we could make it easier. But anyway, Mr. Chair, I'll get off my soapbox now. Thank you.
Representative Krupp, I think you've engendered some questions and discussions with others. But on that line, I think there's an interaction that's almost a coefficient. The difficulty of developing land under the current land use patterns has created a demand in successive legislative sessions for exemptions or outright uses that have been approved in a consistent, continuous manner for outright uses in land on farmland. You know, every session there's two or three bills that we look at that are add to the roster of outright permitted uses on farmland. You know, and that was, I think, what precipitated your question and the issue of this youth camp on farmland in eastern Oregon. The complexity and the difficulty forced people to come to the legislature to ask for a solution, and the solution has been to go to the agency and say, well, can't you make the rules a little easier to work with? And the answer consistently has been, it's not legal. And then the result is an additional category added to the legality of uses that are outright permitted uses on forest and farmland. And then we begin essentially the cycle again, offering a legislated solution, and then go through the workings of the rulemaking process. And then years later, you encounter the same people, and they still have not gotten through the process. because of the complexity of the rules. And I think the impulse is not to create exemptions or rules that encourage development, because that does encourage the conversion of land. But to make the rules impossible, even unintentionally so, just raises the demand in the legislative process for more legislated solutions that create outright uses. You know, so the thing doesn't go away. The problem isn't solved. The problem just morphs into another iteration or another venue, or we get through another legislative session and you end up with three or four more outright permitted uses on farm and forest land. You know, I don't know how we break that other than to say to the agency, protection is the goal, preservation of farm and forest land is the objective, but outright prohibitions against the use of the land is not getting us there. You know, it just creates more pressure for more solutions that create and engender more frustrations and more rules. You know, I'm amazed by the complexity of the cuts that they've got. Representative Bowman, you are in line behind Cedric Hayden and Representative Hanson, and then you have been leafing through the Oregon revised statute.
I'm going to address your issue, Representative.
Drops the bomb and walks out of the room.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Senator, Representative Hayden, if you will defer then the question to Representative Hanson, we'll keep your powder dry.
All right. Okay. All right.
Representative Hanson, you are a recognized.
Well, just a quick comment on that issue. I think there's a natural dynamic between the legislature and our the regulatory agencies. I crafted an absolute brilliant piece of legislation relating to the boiler board of rules. And by the time the building codes agency got done implementing it, it didn't quite accomplish what we'd set out to do. But it's a fine balancing act sometimes between curbing legislative enthusiasm and making it fit within all of the other rules and responsibilities that agencies have. And I didn't take it personal, or you know, I think it's a dynamic that happens, and it may be one of the byproducts of term limits. That sometimes it takes an awful lot of experience and just experience in terms of dealing with how something's going to be crafted so that it fits with what the agency's responsibilities are. I don't think it's peculiar to this agency.
Well, Representative Hanson, you've been. I think that's an accurate characterization. There is a give and take, and it does take experience. Add to that honest disagreements and honest misperceptions, and then some personal biases that inevitably creep into our considerations. And that, you know, is just as true for legislators as it is for administrators. Then it really does get to be a pretty complex issue. Representative Bowman, you have a question or a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to compare this conversation to the conversation we have every session about gun control. Unfortunately, we always have the conversations out on the extreme ends, and I think most people are in the middle somewhere, and most people want the flexibility of doing things that make sense, but they also want to make sure there's some common sense rules in place that don't prevent people from that encourages people to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. I also agree with the good representative from North Portland when he talks about term limits, because I've watched this session, how many bills that I've seen over the last three sessions that we fix because somebody had a great idea about this piece of legislation. And we spend every next session fixing the brilliance of the session before. And so at some point, we're going to have to decide as a state really what it is we want. You know, what do we really want? Do we really want thoughtful, intelligent people sitting together, getting the people in the middle to decide what's good for the state?
That you're not describing the legislative process there.
No,
correct.
I'm definitely not.
But I understand the impulse.
But it definitely contributes to the frustration because we continue to operate at the fringe ends and, you know, in some way. And maybe it's not the legislative process, but there must be a way to get the people who agree most together to figure out how to do this stuff. So that's my only comment.
Questions, comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I believe that...
In the absence of Representative Krupp, I'll jump in anyway.
Representative Hayden is recognized.
Thank you, sir. Well, I think it was a day or two ago, I addressed with some passion the fact that three of my six children had not been able to get a building permit in Oregon as yet. Three had gotten building permits after a time span of some 3 to 5 years and $10,000 to $30,000 in various fees. I felt myself becoming more and more irritated as I discussed it, so I stopped. But that's a problem, and I still have two or three children and nine grandchildren that need a place to live, and it's very difficult for them to find places to live. And yesterday on the floor of the House, Representative Krupp made an impassioned plea for the Oregon farmer because they're being forced out of business, and we started to address this. And he was asking, what are we protecting the farmland from? And my question is, if in the future we're going to have vast tracts of farmland lying fallow, unused because they can't afford to farm it, what in fact are we protecting that farmland for or from?
You know, I assume, Representative Hayden, your question's not rhetoric, but I don't know whether or not Mr. Benner's crystal ball is any better than anyone else's is. But, Mr. Benner, do you want to take a whack at that?
Well, just one thought, and most of you have been in the state of Oregon long enough to have seen it, but I think about the example of the Red Hills of Dundee. 40 or 50 years ago, they were in prune and walnut orchards, and some disturbance of the national markets made growing those two commodities unprofitable. The county, when it did its first comprehensive plan, designated those hills in 5-acre parcels. About the time that they made that rezone, Senate Bill 100 passed, LCDC adopted Goal 3 on agricultural lands, and the county had to change the land use designation of the hills from rural residential to farm use. And it never went back to prune or walnut orchards, but today it's in extremely valuable vineyards of relatively small size, somewhere between 5 and 100 acres per vineyard. And I guess the point is there are temporary disturbances to farm and farm commodity markets that don't necessarily signal long-term trends. If this does turn into a long-term matter, then it probably makes sense for the state to revisit its policy. But it probably, I would argue that it doesn't make sense in the short term because we really don't know whether what we're seeing is a long or a short-term phenomenon.
I think the issue revolves around the question of foreclosure of alternatives in the future, provocated by a short-term change in circumstances. I think the Forest Service and other federal agencies talk about the irrevocable commitment of resources. Once you've irrevocably committed a resource, you foreclose the decision forever. That becomes a powerful impulse to inertia. The Forest Service is now one of the largest non-management agencies in America.
Amen.
They get a lot of money. They have a lot of people. Forests are in worse condition they've been in 100 years in America, 50 years in Oregon at least, if you look at the whole forest base. And in comparison with private lands and state-managed lands, national forest lands are in very much more deteriorated condition. So the issues are, you know, we have to be prudent, but we can't be inert. That's the issue. I suggest that we do have a solution before us, but not necessarily in committing permanently our resources. Mr. Benner, your agency, in the interim, looks to what permanent committee for legislative oversight?
Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use.
And in the rulemaking of process, the rulemaking authority is clearly vested in the administrative branch of government. Chairs of legislative committees that are designated as oversight committees can always request rulemaking of the agency. Is that not so?
That is correct.
So colleagues, you know, thus endeth the lesson. You may, as chairs, ask for rulemaking at any time during the interim. And you may rely on the outcome of the rulemaking, although you may not craft the rule. In other words, you can ask for a rule that accomplishes a specific goal, but you may not write the rule. That's specifically vested in the executive branch. And through the legislative oversight committees, those rules can be heard and recrafted and redrafted in terms of outcome, not in terms of how. It's specifically vested in the executive branch, but the objective can always be refocused in those legislative oversight committees. So I'm going to suggest to our colleagues, Representative Hayden and others, that if you've got frustration over the rulemaking issues, the place that those get addressed when we're not in session is through the committees that have designated legislative oversight through the requests for rulemaking by the chairs. That's the way we try to deal with those things. I think it's not a very well-known interactive mechanism that we have to deal with legislative efforts that are brilliant on their face.
Oh, I was so impressed.
Efforts of pure poetry when by the legislative branch and somehow turn into something less than that after they have had rules written. But that's the place where we get those issues addressed. I am dangerously close to violating my promise to speak less than I listen. And that was my promise to the chairman when I took the gavel. So if there are no other questions from the committee for Mr. Benner on the issue before us, which in fact is the legislative budget for Senate Bill 5530, which is the budget for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Are there more questions for Mr. Benner or his staff? Hearing and seeing none, I believe we have concluded then the presentation of Senate Bill 5530. We have the summary before us, and for that we will turn to Mr. Benner, who will bring together all of the diverse information that's been presented here.
Well, as a matter of fact, Senator, what I would like to do is, since the presentation has given you little pieces of what we do, I would like to leave you with my vision and the department's vision for where it believes it is going and taking the land use program, which may not come through.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute and ask you for something that I consider to be a consideration for the chairman and yourself. Since we have not scheduled a work session for today, and may not even do that Monday, if I understand what's before us on the agenda, would you like to withhold your summation so that that can be made before the chairman, who would then move to work session on this bill? Or would you like to issue the summation now and take your chances with the chairman for Washington, D.C.? Oh. No, I will leave that to your discretion. The committee is fully prepared to hear your summation now.
I think it makes some sense to hold it until, and she is not the only member of the committee missing, so I would be willing to take my chances.
You'd like to withhold your summation?
I think that's a good idea.
Immediately prior to the work session. Colleagues, you think that's the prudent thing to do?
Yes.
I do as well. In consideration to our chairman, then, we will withhold the summary of the DLCD budget and Mr. Benner's presentation until, would that be Tuesday then?
We're not sure just when. We want to have a chance to have the Coastal Caucus review some of the issues. And based on the outcome of
that scheduled for tomorrow morning at 7.
And there may need to be some time to work it into the other agenda. Next week, Ag is scheduled for the entire week. So I don't know when a work session can be worked into the schedule just yet.
Well, in consideration of the meeting of the Coastal Caucus tomorrow and in consideration of the absence of the chair, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 55. 30 and ask Mr. Benner to connect with the chairman of the committee, Representative Morgan, when she returns, probably on Monday. And I will assume that she will schedule the summation and work session immediately there following. Any other questions or business to come before the committee? In hearing and seeing none, we are in adjournment until
Monday.
Monday morning, or Monday afternoon at 1 p.m., same location.